Mark, O mighty one, our sacrifice begins. We commence.
Welcome to Spellbird, a podcast about the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. It's time to party like it's 1974.
Good evening, judges.
Good evening, Judge Jen.
Very good, class. For the newcomers, I'm Judge Jen, and with me are my illustrious co-hosts, the predominant Judge Julian.
Hello.
And the stro-famous Judge Jeff.
Whoa-ho-ho, hello.
And tonight we're going to hit page 128 with a vengeance. That's right, in this episode of Spellburn, we're going to help out the new clerics, or confused wizards out there, by running through a level 1 spell primer. We did the first level arcane spells about a year ago, so it's past time for this next set. Whether you're new to the game or a longtime judge, some spells aren't taken seriously or used to their full potential because they're taken at face value. And if you're like Judge Jeff and think deities are just glorified patrons, these could potentially become patron spells. The world is not binary and the whole class should pay attention. So, without any ado, let's head on over to Tavern Talk.
Welcome, friends! Good to see you!
I only had one drink to calm my nerves.
Innkeeper, a drink of your most expensive.
Tavern Talk.
All right, so what have we done in gaming the past week or two? Jeff, start with you.
Well, I am ashamed to say this is the first time since I've been on this show that I haven't had any actual gaming since the last episode we recorded. I know. I hope I don't lose my Spellburn card. I did have plans to game that I had to cancel. The last session of Andrew Sternick's campaign, in which I'm playing the 17-year-old girl who was stolen away to Elfland and has come back with a preserved aardvark heart, that campaign.
Yes.
But unfortunately, I had to cancel at the very last minute. My boyfriend had some family in town that showed up without really any warning, and they required some ushering around New York. So I ended up having to do that instead, which was very fun, and I'm glad that I did it. But my one opportunity to game since our last episode went away. But I will be joining them for the next session on Sunday, so hopefully I'll have a meatier story for you guys next time.
All right, fair enough. I mean, if anyone's going to lose their judge card, well, that'd be me. Julian, any more luck over there?
Really what I did is sort of tangentially related to DCC, but we played a game of Death is the New Pink a couple weeks ago, which was created, of course, by Mr. Hubris himself, Mike Evans, who also created a game named Hubris, and or a setting for DCC named Hubris, of course, any Silver Award winner. And
yes.
Yeah, we had a great time. We Death is the New Pink. All I'm going to say is it's a post-apocalyptic game built on the Into the Odd type engine. If you know that game, Into the Odd, it's a very nice rules light kind of OSR, but not exactly OSR, but it's a D20 chassis with sort of a story engine or something. I don't know. Anyway, it's really a nice game. And, but Death is the New Pink, of course, is completely ridiculous, you know, heads being torn off and all that sort of thing. I think the person who summed it up the best was John Carnes, who said, "When I was 16, this is the role-playing game I really wanted to play." And
nice.
Yeah, because there was a lot of exploding heads and, you know, giant five-story buildings on tank treads and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
It was that kind of thing.
And who was running it?
I ran it. It was kind of sand crawly or something. I don't know what you want to call it exactly, but it it involved like a cannibal gang that worked out of an old laundromat. And I don't know, it just gets weirder and weirder. I repurposed some Thundar decorations for this one. And but
it, you it know, does sound up your alley.
Oh yeah, it was. We had a lot of fun. It turned out pretty well. There was a good spirit of improvisation going, let's just say.
Well, and
very fun.
Wasn't there something else actually DCC related with your name on it, Judge Julian? That is making its way across the airwaves now, or something.
It's true.
Oh, geez.
Plug.
You know I'm too modest to talk about that.
That's why I brought it up for you.
Aw.
Get in there.
yes. No, thank you for the reminder. I have just released our first Nowhere City funnel adventure. The art and the layout by Spencer Amundson, Jack Kotz, and of course the layout by Clint Bohady and all the visual design brilliance that he brings to it. It's really a nice little product. It's a little, it's a small adventure. It's really designed as kind of a con game, should easily fit in a 4-hour slot. It has easily fit every time I've run it. And even with a little pre-gen, time, and it's really, you know, it's Nowhere City. It's a funnel. It's simple to play. And the one sentence version is you're trapped in a underground dungeon, kind of man versus man, woman versus man versus woman, child versus child, in this sort of crazy reality TV tournament to be the one who becomes a sorcerer with the evil sorcerer cult. So, yeah, you know, I released
Sounds
a couple
perfect.
Days ago. Yeah, and I'm happy with it, and who, you know, and now you just sort of hope you can pay for all the beautiful art.
It looks gorgeous.
Yeah, we certainly had a lot of fun, and I'm running it a bunch of times next year or two, so hopefully we'll see some folks at the table and you know, recover a few shekels, and you know, that's what it's about.
So now, is Clint Bohady Order of the Quill?
Yes.
Yes, he's the publisher emeritus, executive vice president, and grand poobah, I guess you could say.
Because I've got to say, all of the products I have by Order of the Quill are just absolutely stunning pieces. They're really beautifully printed with great artwork and great design, and they're just really satisfying to have in your hand as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Speaking of, save me one,
he's
Julian.
Quite good. Oh yes, well they're in. There's no shortage of them, so I'm happy to distribute them liberally all around.
Yay!
Fantastic.
For a small fee.
Well, yeah.
And remember, Grandma needs Nowhere City. The name of this adventure is Outlive, Outsmart, Outkill. Just so we said it.
Okay.
With an exclamation point at the end of each word, right?
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
As it should be. Well, my gaming per se has been fairly light like yours. We did finally finish Barrier to the Expedition Peaks.
Ooh.
Brain is fried on that one. We spent way too many sessions in there. So now we're bouncing through to the next thing that the Demon Web Pits has to offer. In DCC-related news, the holiday module, the X-Crawl New Year's Evil dropped. That was a lot of fun to work on. I finished up the patron AIs for Stephen Newton's Children of the Fallen Sun, and finally got Grimtooth off my desk. That was awesome. I'm getting back into some of the DCC Lankmar adventures, and that's been a lot of fun to dive back into. And I'm helping out the guys over at Operation Unfathomable, which has been quite the adventure. And other than that, just kind of drowning in year end, which my fellow bean counters can probably commiserate with at this point.
Yep.
So, nothing too terribly exciting there. Yeah, we can head out of the tavern and summon some email, shall we?
We shall.
I call upon the flame to summon you.
Who'll deliver the message for me?
I came here to give you these facts.
Summon email.
All right, emails. Looks like our first one is from Rob from Minneapolis. Hello, Burners. I hear loads of praise heaped upon the concept of the character funnel in DCC, and it seems like a big helping of material and airtime is devoted to it. I can only presume that most people like them and give good feedback about them. My report differs considerably. We have one person in our weekly game group who loves DCC and started a game with a funnel, Sailors. Player response and buy-in was tepid at best. Here's why I didn't think it worked so well with my group, and why I don't like the whole funnel concept. First, rather than making the players more fond of their survivors, I believe the funnel disconnects the players from their PC. We didn't have a hand in making these PCs. We were just handed four sheets generated at Purple Sorcerer, and it felt like we all had a bunch of henchmen we were running. That was reinforced by the death rate that quickly turned the game to grim comedy. All the PCs quickly were tagged with dumb names derivative of their profession, Buzz the Beekeeper, Buzzmati the Rice Farmer, etc., and nobody really took it seriously. Two, you aren't even really playing DCC. Anyone who's played in an OSR game or a version of the world's most popular RPG would think there's nothing novel about DCC other than the luck mechanics. You don't have any of the unique rules operating at zero level. No spells, no mighty deeds, no cleric powers, no thief abilities. Hell, not even any of the non-human PCs get their racial abilities. Other than what the judge fills in, it's complete vanilla gaming with woefully bad PCs. Three, all the survivors are first level anyway, so was there really a point? Couldn't we have just made first level PCs and started playing the real game with all its cool ideas and mechanics from the get-go? Four, I'm no Appendix N scholar, but I have read a good deal of it. Where's the precedent there for a funnel? At least among the swords and sorcery genre of N, the heroes start out pretty badass. Elric, Conan, Fawford, and Grey Mouser don't start as gong farmers, tailors, bakers, and gravediggers, at least not in the stories I read. Anyway, just curious if my group is unique somehow and not enjoying the funnel at all. Have you heard these concerns from others? We actually didn't even play much beyond that, in part, I think, because nobody much cared about their PC. To be clear, we're largely a bunch of people in our mid to late 40s who cut their teeth on AD&D and other old school games in the 80s, and that's generally the type of games we still play. I really enjoy the podcast and admire DCC for its interventions, though I use it strictly for inspiration and ideas to use in the RPG I created for our group. These are simply my findings and opinions. I don't mean to invalidate or belittle anyone else's by voicing them. Whew, boy. Okay, that's meaty. Who wants it?
So, Rob, thank you for your email. I really appreciate it when people are willing to send emails that have kind of take kind of a controversial stance on something, is I guess what I can say. So, my experience is quite different from yours, but I would say that I have had players who have experienced things similar to you. I think the point is that it does a really good job of introducing us to the kind of the vibe and grittiness and the feel of Dungeon Crawl Classics and how it's different. Because, you know, the whole thing where it's like, you are no hero. And it's like, it's true. To begin with, you're not walking out the gates as some great, fantastic hero. You really are just some farmer who picked up a pitchfork and is probably going to get your head ripped off by a tentacle. And that's kind of fun and it's wild. And it's a new way of looking at gaming. And the idea of like that we aren't really playing DCC, I completely see what you're saying, that like one of the like the parts that people really love about DCC tend to be the magic system and the luck mechanic and all of these like very kind of like wild things about DCC. And it's true that you don't have access to a lot of the character class features yet. But I think that the funnel is also in and of itself a very unique part of DCC. And you are absolutely playing DCC when you're playing the funnel, because the idea of the highly fatal beginning adventure where most of you are going to die is totally part of this particular game. But I do feel like most people I know who play campaign games, they might start their whole campaign off with a funnel, but oftentimes they're not going to then go back to a funnel mid-campaign. Like it's either a con setting, just kind of massive massacre, or it's a campaign starter. And in that sense, I really do like it. In terms of your reference to not being an Appendix N scholar, but you've read a good deal of it, that I completely agree. I have no experience. I've read quite a bit of the Appendix N now, and I have yet to encounter an Appendix N story where we have a large mob of characters, of which most of them are slaughtered, and then a few of them rise up to become adventurers. Now, I have heard, I recently had a conversation with this about somebody on with somebody online, and their counter argument to that was that, yes, but most of the characters you find in the Appendix N are regular people who find themselves in extraordinary circumstances. Like Harold Shea is just a psychologist, a modern day psychologist who finds himself, you know, battling giants in the plane of Norse mythology. So in that sense, it is kind of Appendix N. But ultimately, to me, I do kind of agree with the criticism that it doesn't feel very Appendix N. But whatever. I mean, it's fun and I enjoy it. So just because that particular part doesn't have a root in Appendix N doesn't seem to bother me too much. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think Rob's observations are actually pretty spot on. I mean, I've heard people give the same criticisms before, and I totally get it. I've been at cons where I've run funnel games and people are like, oh, I didn't know it was a funnel game. Even though, of course, it says it's a zero level game or whatever. But anyway.
Let it all out, Julian.
here's the confession. I myself did not like funnel games at all. I didn't like running them, and I didn't like playing them. But I kind of came around after a year or two to I think it was almost maybe Jared, you know, when we were doing Spellbrand stuff with Jared last year, he kind of turned me on to how the funnel is the simplest, most rules-free implementation of DCC. It's the closest thing to a pure narrative. And that way, it's the most wild-eyed and free-roaming version of the game. On the one hand, like Rob says here, you know, it's just complete vanilla gaming with woefully bad PCs, or it's completely crazy. Anything can happen, and a guy with a duck might have a huge advantage over a guy with no duck. You know, you know how that is. So anything's possible. So I think Judge Jared really turned me on to how fun and different funnel type games can be versus typical D&D-ish games and so on. And I really began to think of it as a different way of doing it. As far as survivors being first level anyway, was there really a point? Well, you know, nobody will complain, and many people would not even know if you begin your campaign at first level. So just do it. You know, whatever. It's not, you know, you're not really doing a criminal disservice to anybody. So that's not really a problem. But my major quibble is Rob, you're missing the most important appendix and influence on the funnel, who is not Moorcock, who is not Howard, who is not Leiber, and so forth, or even Vance. The most important one, I would argue, is Lovecraft. And the reason I say that is because for Lovecraft, you are nothing but an insignificant speck in the just a mote in the eye of a god who, even if he did or could notice you, certainly wouldn't even begin to know how to care. So you know, in a sense, I think the funnel is the truest implementation of that Lovecraftian vision. Even Conan, you know, Howard and Lovecraft were friends, and even Conan lives in Lovecraft's world, right? I mean, to some degree, that's a literal thing. Like, they traded names and monsters and, you know, Nyarlathotep and stuff like that a little bit here and there in the margins. But in addition, I mean, I think Lovecraft's vision influenced those guys a lot. And I think that's the worldview that permeates all this. I mean, even as great as Fofford and Mouser are, they're always getting screwed over and double crossed, and fate double crosses them, and they're always getting turns of bad luck. I mean, I think the world is hostile, and that's the way that I think the vibe in the world of Appendix N supports the funnel.
I'm just going to chime in on number three about all the survivors being first level anyway at the end of the funnel. If it's a con game, sure. If it is part of a campaign that's starting, if I'm running it, you better believe I'm doling out the XP at the end of the game based on what you've done. You don't automatically jump up to first level. You might be a zero level for the next session too. But that's just me. Your judge mileage may vary.
Yeah, well, that's fair. That's fair.
Okay, yeah, I think we beat that one into the ground.
But it's a great email.
All right, and our next email comes from Dan Stebe. Dear Judges Jay, I have thoroughly enjoyed all things DCC since discovering it less than a year ago, and have really enjoyed the DIY spirit and communities around it. I feel like it has given me an outlet to be fantastically creative again and has put me in touch with many great and like-minded people. Spellburn has been a major contributor to this enjoyment and learning, so thank you for your efforts. Editor's note, you're welcome, Dan, and I've seen you on G+. That's pretty cool. Thanks for contributing, and onward. Okay, back to Dan. I was fortunate enough to be able to participate in contributing to this year's Gong Farmer's Almanac, and really struggled to provide what I thought would be meaningful content in the suggested 2,000 words or less guidelines. I also felt like I was at a loss of what to give the people when submission links are in play, and I was not sure whether a couple brief but well-detailed encounters would be better received than a broad and general description of an area or scenario that would still take work on the judge's part to prepare, populate, and build out as they saw fit. Finally, when you are creating content that you intend to use for distribution of some sort, how does one best ensure that what you're authoring will be useful to other judges or readers and not relevant only to one's own home game table? Perhaps some wisdom on selective trimming, cutting, and editing can be shared, as I know there is at least one hardened editor within the ranks of Spellburn judges. Where is that zen-like balance for content? I feel that it must fall somewhere between Paizo's Adventure Path, aka 600 pages of glossy pictures and fluff, and the rumored Gary Gygax encounter notes of legend consisting of three words, sand and giant crab. Also, I'm very curious about the process that the GFA masterminds took to take the disparate submissions for this year's publications and forge them into a hex crawl. I've not had time to pore over the almanacs yet, so I cannot opine on what I think about them or whether this attempt was a success or not. I'm curious as to how much effort was put into massaging and rewriting content to make it work within a hex crawl context, and what the project coordinators thought of the overall effort this year compared to the previous. Keep up the good fight in spite of the risk of corruption and patron disapproval, and I hope to see as many of you all as I can at the next GaryCon.
Yay!
Yay!
And I think all three of us will be there.
Oh, yeah, ooh, yes, we will.
And in as a cool little note, Dan Stebe was one of the people that came and visited Bob and I as we were evacuated during the hurricane. So that was a fun little bit of serendipity. To address the Gong Farmer's Almanac concerns, I actually took the liberty of contacting Mr. Stroh and Mark Bruner, our two powers that be besides Taco John, that deal with the Gong Farmer's Almanac each year. You know, this year, Harley had that vision of creating a grand mosaic of the connected, self-contained adventure locations, and apparently that was a bit of a struggle compared to the usual anything goes attitude, because there was that context shift. But as far as, you know, rewriting and whatnot, there's, to address Dan's concern, there's very little rewriting done with any of the submissions. You know, it's still crowdsourced editing process. So he's seen you know, some of the editors just, the authors have the sanity check going on because, oh my God, someone's actually looking at their work and pulling it apart and making the corrections that need to be made. And other times it's this super collaborative mesh that might result in a lot of rework and some enhancements that get carried forward. But you're totally right. 2,000 words is a huge limitation, and not knowing exactly what's expected. Yeah, I don't know if they're going to end up doing the hex crawl thing again next year, because that was a huge, huge project. But as a fun little trivia note, for something that's it's free, they've had over 20 print issues released over 3 years. So it's an absolutely insane amount of work and time that all three of them put into it just to make sure that the Gong Farmer's Almanac comes off on any given year. So personally, I thank everybody who contributed to it and everybody who's editing on that, because even if I had time, I don't know if I would have the sanity.
All I can say is I don't think in the DIY zine spirit of the Gong Farmer's Almanac, I think they thought of a cool idea and went and did it. I don't think it was elaborately strategized and focus grouped ahead of time. And
that's probably fair.
Yeah. And, I don't say that obviously in any derogatory way. I love that spirit of just getting out and doing it. It was a ton of work. And I know John was and Mark and Harley and everybody did a ton of work on it. I submitted a submission too. Anyway, it was, the spirit of GFA is we're going to do some stuff, and then we did it. And then, I don't know, is it cool? Is it bad? I don't know. Read it and tell us, use it. Let's see what happens. That's the spirit of it. We're going to do it, and we're going to find out if it is cool. So, that's a great, it's a great resource, and it's a great exercise. And just the process of it is pure DIY and DCC. So,
kind of goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
I agree completely. And I also had a hex crawl submission, and my hex crawl was pretty goofy. And if you look at what it's up against, some of the hexes that it was adjacent to are some very darkly, darkly serious hexes. So if your players were actually going through this hex crawl, there would be a pretty major tone shift quite suddenly. And the thing is, either it works or you make it work, I kind of like that there wasn't too much effort put into really laboring over making each hex work next to each other. It's just kind of I feel like it's we're just going to trust that it'll work out, and you'll take what you like and ignore the rest.
That's a great way to put it. And a great segue too. Hey guys, if any of you out there have run stuff from the GFA, tell us about it. We always need more emails. Of course, that's theband@spellburn.com. And if you guys don't have anything else, we can move it on over to Mighty Deeds.
Let the combat begin! To the death!
By behold, our hero.
So you want to play rough, eh? We'll take this!
Mighty Deeds.
All right, Mighty Deeds. Cleric spells. Yes, let's do this thing. I guess first off, we should address the rules as written with the spell like abilities. Judge Jeff, try to be nice.
I'll be on my best behavior.
There are people who do enjoy playing clerics. And
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with playing clerics. All I was saying is I don't understand why wizards can't cast these spells. That's all I'm really saying.
Well, and vice versa, really. So we've just got the different schools of spells. And maybe we should look at it that way, kind of a building on the arcane affinity. Mm-hmm. So we just have different foci for these, being deities in this case. So we've got Lay on Hands, which can heal hit points or physical conditions. I think you wanted to talk about Divine Aid.
Yeah. So I guess the three are, Lay on Hands, Turn in Holy, and Divine Aid are the three spell/spell-like abilities that all clerics have. And I've got to say that one of my favorite ones is Divine Aid. I think Divine Aid is so much fun, both as a player and as a judge. One great example for me of a really good use of Divine Aid is I was playing in an adventure that I would love to plug, but I'm afraid that the thing I'm going to say will be a bit of a spoiler. So I'm not actually going to say the name of the product, but we were playing an adventure where these bats come down and these bats steal your head. And this bat comes down and it starts stealing one of the heads of one of the characters. It was a wizard named Zora. It started stealing Zora's head. And so Volrath, who is our cleric of Bugmobiles, is like, oh, I'm going to go and I'm going to cut the bat off. So he goes over with his dagger and starts cutting the bat off of the woman's head, and he fumbles. And since the since the bat was like right around the head and like kind of pulling at the neck, it's like, I'm sorry, but you've now slit her throat. And we did some damage to Zora. Zora died, and so the bat takes off with Zora's head. But previously, I had mentioned that when the bat came down before, it had a head already attached to it. It had spit it off, and the head that it had spit off was like gasping for air and was slowly dying. So the next person killed the bat. The head popped off. And Volrath runs over, grabs the head that's gasping for air, shoves it onto the dead stump of Zora's former body, and calls for divine aid and asks for Bugmobiles to reattach this head. Now, in Dungeon Crawl Classics, we don't have resurrection, we don't have reincarnation. None of these spells really exist. But in the fiction, in that moment, because we had this head that was gasping for air, and as he just kind of shoved it onto the bloody stump, it made sense to me. And he took the 10-point disapproval, called upon the Bugmobiles, had a nice good roll. So what I said is that when it worked. So what ended up happening was in the area where the head had been detached, there was a nice big meaty ring around her neck. When her eyes opened, she now had frog eyes because it was Bugmobiles. And now and her alignment became chaotic. And every time she casts a spell, there's now flies buzzing around her and the smell of the swamp. So you can take something like Divine Aid and use it to insert a lot of flavor and have a lot of fun with the fiction that you're in. And it's a great opportunity and a great challenge for judges to learn to say yes to things.
Yes,
because
and.
I think it's really yeah. Because I think it's really easy to like you get a really ridiculous Divine Aid request, and I completely empathize with the initial impulse to shut it down and say no to that. You're trying to game the system. You're taking this too far. I encourage you to find a way to make it work, because you can have so much fun with Divine Aid if you can make it work in your game.
And last time I tried, I rolled a 2 and still got the 10 points of disapproval for it.
Ouch. I'm just gonna add that the best time I've seen it implemented was last year at North Texas when I was running X-Crawl. And it was quite a great moment at the end of that session where the cleric was a cleric. He was a Christian cleric, actually, in the X-Crawl sort of weird parody modern 20th century world. And he summoned Jesus, and Jesus body slammed the dragon that they were fighting. So enough said. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay. And of course, Turn Unholy is depends on what your deity says is holy, your alignment, etc. It's not just undead. At this point, I'm going to refer everyone to either page 30 or to episode 10, the Holier Than Thou Spellburn episode, where they went over the cleric as a class. And instead, we're going to jump over to the first level spells here. So if we jump over, yeah, for anyone following along, page 255, just taking a look at the first level cleric spells. The idea here, again, is to elaborate on, don't just look at the spell name, look at what it can do. You know, the first one looks a little intimidating because there's three columns on it, because you can cast blessing on yourself or an ally or an object. You know, it starts out at one action to cast. Duration can be a turn or more. And you know, the whole effect of this spell. It bestows increasing bonuses on your rolls, your saves, etc. Of course, it's most powerful when cast upon yourself, and it's got this exuding aura to help allies, up to armies even. And the highest result gives you a permanent effect of that blessing. Right. Items are harder to cast on. Like, I think you fail until you hit a 14 for your success. But the items are then made holy to your alignment or deity again. And the wielders gain bonuses. Casting on targets with opposing alignments can incur penalties. And the location where you're at when you cast can imbue either penalties or bonuses to your spell results. Like if you're in a place of holiness, if you're in your deity's chapel, for instance, the judge may give you up to a +4 on your spell result, depending on what's going on.
I thought that was the most interesting as I was rereading these, boning up, doing my homework.
Good boy.
It was the most interesting part of the spell. And in fact, I think we talked about this on the one that we did about a year ago, kind of gaming the system, or breaking the game, rather, I think was the title of that episode. We talked about how powerful Bless can be, but I don't think we dove into that penalty thing. And if you're a party of varied alignments and you're casting on your comrades who are chaotic while you're lawful and so on, you're going to get penalties. And that does sort of mitigate that because you're obviously unlikely to be a completely homogeneous alignment party. A location of casting, even more so, and you're highly likely to be, when you're trying to cast Bless, you're highly likely to be in a freaking evil chapel of an ancient demon, right? So that's something that had totally, I think, that I can't remember we talked about on that episode, but it's a great, I mean, that's just great flavor and great role-playing to bring into those situations. So judges, including myself, should be more cognizant of that.
Right. Yeah, even as a player, I looked at that the last time I played and went, oh crap, that's right.
I want to just add that at the bottom of page 257, Stefan's illustration of the guy with the chaos. It's got to be one of my favorite DCC pictures in any book, in any adventure, et cetera, et cetera. I just love that. So I had to call him out.
That
good
is
work,
nice.
Stefan.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yes.
Okay. Next.
Okay, darkness. Darkness. So one action or more to cast. It has a duration of one turn or more. Just pretty hefty. You know, it's darkness spell. You've seen this one, no pun intended, before.
Har.
No light penetrates. Yes. Creatures within are blinded.
Okay, I was slow with that one.
20, from a 20-foot radius surrounding the cleric to 40-foot to 200 feet away, et cetera, et cetera. Giant cones, spheres, lines of darkness. I will say I was a little... I mean, I'm sorry, but my biggest thing here was I was looking for like permanent sun death in the highest bracket.
It's close.
I mean, it's pretty good, but 500 foot. I mean, why not 5,000 foot or
500 foot is to begin with. But the longer you concentrate, it begins to grow until it gets to a maximum range of cleric's level times 1,000 feet. So if you're a 10th level cleric, it's now 10,000 feet. So that's like 2 miles or something. Where the sun's completely blotted out. That's pretty badass.
That's pretty good.
And even flames emit less light each round. And when the concentration is broken, that light reappears at the same rate it was extinguished at. So it doesn't magically become bright again.
I'm still going for permanent sun death.
Yeah, I'm with you, though. Because at the very least, that 10,000-foot range, it should at least like completely affect that area until some kind of a curse is lifted.
Okay, so you know...
Not just while you're concentrating.
If you're judging and someone rolls a nat 20 on it, go for it.
Sure.
I mean...
Fair. Well, I mean, to be fair, they didn't want to just randomly end people's campaigns.
No, there are other spells to do that.
as a footnote, I did actually do permanent sun. I, as a player, precipitated that in a campaign we were playing in once, and it was ugly.
One thing I would say about darkness is my experience both in DCC and in any other version of D&D that has the darkness spell, it's so hard for me to ever find a good use for this spell. Like occasionally the right moment comes up, but usually it's one of those spells that if you have, in my experience, it's just kind of sitting on your spell list, sitting there uncast. Or when you do try to use it, it usually never works as well as I hoped it would in that situation. It usually just ended up making it just as difficult for the PCs as it did for the monsters.
I have a small anecdote. I used it from the NPCs on the characters.
Mm.
And I have regrets. It made my life a little bit more difficult than it needed to be in the combat range, but as for making the players feel completely hopeless by the end of the session, I pretty much succeeded.
And if you want to have your big like Skeletor, like, oh, He-Man, how dare you? And then like you disappear and like you run, like your villain runs off. If you kind of want that big moment, I guess darkness would be a great spell for that.
Well, the fact that for sure. You can get it into a cone or just a line of darkness, that kind of fascinates me. You can't see past this veil.
The real question I've struggled with a few times is, as a judge, when the cleric casts it and gets a pretty nice result, you know, has he actually forewarned his comrades on this at all, or is everybody just suddenly blundering around in the darkness?
Well, that's why it's best to get a higher result so you can put it somewhere off of yourself, right?
Of course, but it doesn't usually work out that way. And, you know, so you can be kind of charitable and be like, well, you know, you're in the darkness. You know, you guys have cast this spell before, so you're not totally surprised at dot, 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 dot. Or, you know, whatever. Suddenly it's dark. You know, mm-hmm. everybody, you know, I'm taking the map away. What are you doing?
Yep. Okay.
Shall we move on?
Yeah.
All right. Next, we have Detect Evil. Detect Evil takes one action to cast. It lasts for 6 turns, or as we like to say, 1 hour.
Nice.
And what does Detect Evil do? Well, Detect Evil is one of those spells where you can detect creatures of opposing alignments. You can also use it to detect things like traps and poisoned weapons and things like that. At the lowest level of this spell, basically you've got creatures who get a will save so that they can remain undetected. But then at the highest level of Detect Evil, you are just immediately aware of everything around you that's evil or has evil intention toward you. And it doesn't even have to be something that's intentionally evil. If, for example, there's just like a really angry giant Wolverine who's like hungry and wants to eat you and your party, it may not be evil. It doesn't have some diabolical plan to take over the world, but at least you're gonna recognize that this thing is there and present. And it's within 300 feet and nothing really blocks it. So you'll know that beyond those 3 rooms there's something that's emanating evil or what have you. I don't know. I think it's a pretty useful spell as a player, especially in a dungeon crawl, because all of the traps are just revealed to you. So it's kind of a bummer of a spell when that happens as a judge, though, because it's like, all right, this dungeon had some really fun traps, and now I just have to tell you all about them.
At the higher levels, the creatures detected by the spell are quote-unquote pained by the light of truth.
Yeah.
And they get penalties to attacks, damage, skill checks, spell checks, and saving throws while within that, oh my god, 300 feet of you. Yeah. So that's pretty hefty.
I don't care for that aspect of the higher rolls, but it's different and it's kind of fun in a sense, but
if you were a player, you'd like it just fine.
I probably would, yes. especially if I burned a lot of luck to get there.
I do like that it can also be reversed. So you can find creatures of allied alignments or those with a common deity to you or similar holy goals. I think that's something that is very underplayed.
I call the reverse of that spell find friends.
There we go.
I call it find evil friends.
For you, so, that's not a misnomer. Yeah.
Does the reverse of the spell also make really comfortable sofas glow and like delicious foods and like, I don't know.
Your judge may vary.
Very comfy things glow. I mean, because if it's the reverse of like, oh, that thing is trapped or oh, that thing has poison on it, maybe the reverse of that is, oh, that thing is really comfy. You should sit down and relax and open up a good book.
That sounds like a lot of flavor that would be great for a campaign, maybe not so much for con game.
Fair enough. Just
throwing that out there. Okay, so detect evil, pretty simple. Detect magic. This is another one that I hate to run a game when someone is casting this. As a point of note, it takes two actions to cast. So if you're just a first level cleric, you're going to spend two rounds, right? But it lasts for two turns, and you can tell if people, places, or things are enchanted. You start with a 30-foot-long, 30-foot-wide cone at the lower levels, up to 120 feet long, or even range of sight. And the higher results give you more information, such as a cloak being magic but not the wearer. Or you could get the magical properties, as with the spell we all know and love from OD&D and AD&D, Identify. And I think it's the closest thing we have in DCC to the Identify spell. But no matter what level you make on this spell, you cannot detect it if it is behind 3 feet of wood, 1 inch of solid metal, or 1 foot of stone. So it's kind of, you get this going with a dwarf who can smell gold, and as a judge, you're hating life.
Well, the higher levels, it goes through any, through, yeah.
Well, yes. No, it even through, oh yeah, it does go through those if you get 24 or higher, you are correct.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a little rough for the judge, but.
I was thinking, gosh, is that highest result kind of underpowered when I was, you know, doing my homework here? And I will say it reads like that, but when you consider how powerful it is to really exactly understand all the magic that you might interact with in the dungeon environment, that's probably not really quite true. It just sort of reads on paper, it seems that way, but knowledge is power.
Yeah.
And can I cast the reverse of this and cast Detect Mundane?
I mean, if you really need to. And it does stand to note that Detect Evil, while a first level cleric spell, is a second level wizard spell. But a first level wizard can cast Detect Magic, just like a first level cleric. So yeah I know we get into the gray notes there. I'm sorry, Jeff.
No, it's fine. But Julian, I would agree with both. I would agree with you that Detect Magic at its highest level is a little underpowered. And I also think Detect Evil is as well. Neither one of them are spells where when you get the highest result, you're really breaking the universe or changing the world at all. And I like my highest results to actually change the world. And neither of these two spells actually do that. But I would say that the flip side of them that redeem that for me, though, is both of them are spells that are very useful even at their lowest results. So although their highest results aren't as world-breaking as I personally enjoy, they are spells that as a player, if I can get a 12 on it, I'm actually getting some nice little benefit from it as well. So I kind of appreciate it on that level.
And so maybe you don't have to spend that much luck on it.
You can also cast them in full plate if you're a cleric. So, which does kind of mitigate that, right? Like you know, you're not a squishy armor class 10 guy, you know.
That's true.
Then the, so the, that, I think, I mean, I think the cleric may be slightly underpowered in that sense, but has divine favor, has armor and better armor and better weapons and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Okay, so what do we have next?
One of my favorites, Food of the Gods. I don't think I've ever seen anybody cast this in any game I've ever run or played in. And I make pregens with Purple Sorcerer, so like many people or most people or whatever. So, you know, certainly the spell has been there many times. Now, to be fair, I've run a lot of con games. We don't do long hex crawls where this would be extremely useful and so on. 30-foot range. It takes a turn to cast, so it's not something you're going to whip out in the dungeon. So if you focus on dungeoneering, it may not come up a lot. Duration, 24 hours for the food. It can make inedible food edible or magically create food. The amounts of food increase, and higher levels create healing food, which is nice. And then at the highest levels, fruit trees are suddenly laden and the branches are bowing with bounty, which is nice. Mm-hmm. I will say, I think there's an Appendix N inspiration here to one or two of these results. I didn't know if anybody else had spotted it or had that same thought, but that lowest successful result, the 12 to 13, reminded me of the Kugel in Eyes of the Overworld. He gets the amulet from Ayukanu that lets him eat like whatever crap he can find. Mm-hmm. And this spell makes normally inedible food edible. Mm. So I thought, oh, it's kind of a similar idea, but of course Vance tells you how bad it tastes,
or just kind of how non it tastes.
Yes.
Like if you find a piece of wet driftwood and you use a spell and you take a bite out of it, it still just kind of tastes like wet driftwood, but now it has nourishing values.
So if you should find yourself with a player casting this spell, getting that 12 to 13, make sure to really linger on that is my only feedback.
I have seen this game, this spell used in my games, and I also not usually in con settings, but I have seen people use them, and not to feed the party. I've never seen anybody cast this spell just to feed the party, but I have seen it used to draw monsters away. If there was something that was after them, they use it to send the monsters in another direction to go after that food that's sitting there that's not going to fight back. And I've seen people use it with NPCs as an opportunity to really impress them and show them a good time and get on their good sides. But that's pretty much about it. It's not a spell that has a lot of utility, but when I have seen it used, it has often been kind of fun.
And the first time I got a player that wanted to cast this, I wasn't paying attention to the casting time, so I let him cast it during combat. He smothered a bunch of little bird-like things in their nests and just absolutely smothered the monsters.
Mm.
And, okay, well, now that I know it's supposed to take a turn, that could change things, or I could just go with it because it was entertaining.
I think that's the first time that I noticed that the casting time for that spell was a turn. I've also been doing it as a one action. I need to look at casting times more often. I just always assume they're one action.
Yeah, that's why that other one struck me. The detect magic, taking two actions to cast. Yeah. So if you're not level 5, you're taking two full rounds to cast this puppy.
Well, yeah. Right.
And then it lasts for 2 turns, so if he's casting it during combat, it's only going to last for 10 minutes after that combat.
All right, I know what I'm doing. I print out all of the spells for my players, and I always highlight the mercurial effects on the wizard spells. What I'm going to go through is I'm going to get a different colored highlighter, and I'm not going to highlight the casting time on every spell that has a casting time that is anything other than one action. That way, I and the player always know that this is a spell that takes more than an action to cast.
Damn fine plan, sir.
Sorry, players.
I'm sure we'll all get over it at some point. Maybe. Okay, so that was our foods. Next page.
Next is Holy Sanctuary. And Holy Sanctuary, it takes one action to cast, and the duration changes depending on how high of a result you get. And this is basically a spell that is used to create a safe space. This is a safe space. Nobody can harm us here. And at the very lowest level, basically all it really does is make it so that people are kind of disinclined to attack you. So they just get a -2 on their roll. And at the highest result, you have now turned this entire area into a holy sanctuary for your deity. And while it's in, while you're in this holy sanctuary, nothing that has 6-8 hit die or less can attack you at all. Anything that has 7 hit die or more, or is carrying a magical weapon, those people can, but they have to pass a will save. But since you need a 32 to get this anyways, who's going to pass a 32 plus will save? Nobody is. So really,
Manticrex would.
Manticrex would. Okay. Manticrex will attack you in your new holy sanctuary. But this is a spell that I love this. I love that the lowest result is really lame and hardly does anything for you. And I love that the highest result completely changes the game. You now have a, wherever your characters have adventured, you have now turned this into a holy shrine to your god. And, you know, I listened to Jeffrey Tadlock's actual play podcast, The Iron Tavern, and in it they had what must have been a 32 plus result on Holy Sanctuary, because they had that temple to Cthulhu there. And it ended up becoming kind of like how on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, in the first 3 seasons they had the library, and then later in the show they had the magic box. It became like this like location where all of the adventurers hung out, and then they like brought all these crazy things into it. It's like the Peach Pit in 90210. And it's so fun to like in your game now have this like centralized location where you all just kind of like chill and gather. I don't know. I love stuff like that. So this spell, I'm a big fan of it.
Yay, safe place. Yeah, safe places to sleep are important, man.
Yeah, what do you think, Jen?
I like safe places to sleep. I haven't seen anyone get anything higher than like the first or second result in game, so I don't have a whole lot of experience with this one to draw on.
I think you summed it up nicely, Jeff. This is always back to the AD&D games. It's always been one of my very favorite and most useful spells in those odd moments where I would be actually playing a cleric. And it's quite useful. And that those upper results, as you mentioned, Jeff, are awesome. They're, you know, it's funny because it's funny how the game is not a power gamer's game in the sense of creating those meticulous builds and having such impact on the odds and stuff. But at the same time, just as you said, Jeff, that kind of result can radically change the game, right? And it's not that far out of reach. If you got a 20 and you doubled your level, so now you have a 26, all you need to do is burn 6 points of luck, or have the halfling burn 3 points of luck, and suddenly you're up there at a 31, 32, right?
Yeah, if you're a 5th level cleric and you roll a nat 20 on that, you're going to be adding a 10 to your roll, plus your personality modifier. Yeah. So if you got a 20 plus 10 and you've got a personality modifier of +2, already you have that without even spending any luck or having a halfling.
Yeah, so just to say, you can't, I want to say players can really impact the game in huge ways in DCC, but not through feat trees. And it's just, it's that kind of spell.
Yeah.
That's it.
Oh, well said.
Oh, and looking at that again, 10,000 square feet.
That's huge.
Yes.
That is, that's more than 3 times the size of the entire Brinkmanomicon housing. Okay, to move on to the next one, it's a little bit more problematic. Everyone gets excited. Oh, I'm going to cast Paralysis. But there are different stages of this one. Now, this one always takes one action to cast. However, even at the very first level, The whole idea is the cleric's hands and his melee weapons are charged with paralytic energy. The cleric has to make another attack on his next round in order to attack with this effect.
And then they get a will save.
And then if they are paralyzed, it starts out at a D6 plus cleric level rounds, right? Or caster level, yeah. The second phase of this is the cleric can designate targets and then paralyze them with a word. And of course, they still get a save, but the difficulty keeps climbing because the result level is higher. And finally, the cleric retains his paralytic touch for 24 hours and can touch anybody within that 24 hours to paralyze them. And again, they all get will saves. But what I really like is that the second to last result, you get to choose any one of the effects and the duration of the paralysis is doubled. Yeah, again, they still have to make a save. But if you get a 32 plus, you choose any one of the effects above and the duration is permanent. So that paralysis, even if the target makes it save, can only be cured via magical means. Like the spell, Cure Paralysis. Who knew? or Lay on Hands would work if they were so inclined. But that means that you could potentially have a cleric whose mere touch paralyzes an enemy permanently.
That's amazing. And it doesn't even have to be a touch, because on the 20 to 27 range, like the 24 to 27, it says the cleric designates up to 3 targets within 100 feet and paralyzes all of them.
And that would be permanent. And
exactly.
The will save would still be the 32 plus.
But
yes,
but
yes.
Interestingly, until you get to 30 and 31, you can't choose a lower implementation.
True. But there's no...
Yeah.
But none of the lower ones are ever more helpful than... It's not one of those spells where it's kind of a mixed bag.
No.
Like it really does get more and more helpful as you
climb. I disagree, because if you roll the 28 to 29, you still have to touch versus range.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
Like, you're, but a 20
you're
is
so
a range.
Right.
And honestly, it seems... It's kind of...
Hold on. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, that's weird.
But at any point during that time, he can also disable... The paralysis. He could discharge it.
It's a sweet result.
And then
but you still have to, you might not want to go touch the dragon, right?
You
know.
28 to 29 is when you're always going to spend 1 or 2 points of luck. I don't think anybody's going to just stay on that result.
Although your target doesn't get a will save on that one unless they're 7 hit die or higher. Mm-hmm. So that's at least a little bit better.
Yeah.
And then that one, the target stays paralyzed for 4d6 plus caster level hours. Not rounds, but hours. But yeah, I would definitely bump it up to the 32 at that point. Yeah, may as well permanently paralyze him, take him out of play, especially if it's one of the boss battles.
Heck yeah. And that's the kind of game-breaking result I like.
Yeah. That's true. It's very simple to burn a few lux if you get up to that range and a couple lux, or burn the halfling battery down and go from there.
Yeah, you can permanently paralyze 3 targets within 100 feet. That's pretty badass.
And there are only 3 spellburn judges.
Okay, so we start hiring more and...
At the moment.
Note to self.
With some honorary people, of course.
Well, of course.
Yeah. But my quibble with this spell, though, is it's really pretty lame until you get to 20. Like, I do like when, 12 to 13 is kind of lame, and then, it gets a little better. But really, until you get to 20, you have to do the attack. And what bothers me is you have to pass your spell check, then you have to pass your attack roll, and then the person has to fail their will save. And I can get 1 or 2 of those things, but once you have 3 of those things that have to happen in order for the person to get paralyzed, my experience has been that at a result lower than 20, it usually doesn't result in anything. Mm. It's pretty uncommon that anybody actually ever gets paralyzed, because there are 3 different things you have to, 3 different things you have to pass through in order right. for it to happen.
And so between 12 and 19, yeah.
I've seen it happen, but for those of us raised on Hold Person, there's definitely that moment of, oh, come on.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Hold Person is a second level cleric spell in AD&D versus a first level in DCC, so.
Okay, well, we're over halfway through.
Nice.
Julian, you get the next one, I think?
Yeah, Protection from Evil. Action to cast.
You sound so excited. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Protection from prot, evil.
Or as Mr. Mentzer calls it, prot evil. I would say this is kind of boring. Even for DCC. I mean, it's very useful, but it's kind of fiddly. And honestly, I don't know. I mean, it's a good spell. At the higher levels, you're talking about bringing, you know, 2d6 plus 1 to 10. So you can be talking about, on average, 8 to 18 points of damage per round on all enemies in 40 feet. So that's pretty solid.
That's anyone that approaches you.
Within 40
yeah,
feet.
That's kind of nice.
That's pretty hot. I'm not saying it's not useful, but, you know, it's not, I don't know. You know, it is what it is. It's one of those spells that kind of does its thing and then kind of scales up.
It kind of takes in the old prayer as well, because you get a plus 4 to the saving throws against them, but their attacks also have a minus 4 penalty against you.
Mm.
And the damage suffered is reduced by 4 points per die. So that highest level is actually pretty cool. And I'm kind of thinking that that'd be an awesome combo with Holy Sanctuary.
Hmm.
So even if you get a sucky result with Holy Sanctuary, okay, they've got to try to make a save to attack you. But even coming near you, you're dishing out damage at those higher levels on this spell. You don't have to roll to hit them. You don't have to concentrate to keep it going. It stays up for a turn per level. So even at first level, it's staying up for the whole combat.
Yeah, I think functionally it's a very helpful spell. I just think that it's a lot of record keeping and not very flavorful. But absolutely, I can see that it would be useful. No doubt about
this,
that.
This spell is the opposite of me. Boring and useful.
But that's okay. This spell can be reversed, Julian.
Yes.
You can protect from good, which is interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Next.
Okay, so no one's a fan of this? Okay. You guys suck. All right, fine. Give us our next one. You guys are buzzkills.
Okay. The next one is Resist Cold or Heat. And Resist Cold or Heat takes one action to cast. It lasts for at least a round, depending on what happens. And basically, it is a nice big magical warm sweater, or it is a nice big magical big feather fan. So it'll cool you off or warm you up appropriately. The lowest result, basically, you can ignore up to 5 points of heat or cold damage in the next round. And then at the highest result, you are in a sphere of resistance that emanates 50 feet from you. And everybody around you gets like a plus 6 on saving throws against heat and cold stuff. And you also... And you can resist up to 30 points of cold or heat damage per round.
Holy cow.
Yeah. What do you guys think of this?
That's a great one if you're going to the City of Brass and stuff, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it could definitely be overpowered, because what, for a first level cleric, what is going to hit you for more than 30 points per round? Unless you're in a pool of lava.
Yeah. Well, yeah, lava, dragon breath, you know, all that stuff.
I think the spell is nice. I like it. I think that at the lowest level, you know, you ignore the 5 points, but it only lasts for the next round. So you have to know exactly when to cast this thing. You have to see that the dragon's about to breathe fire on you. At the highest result, it's a fiddly complaint. instead of 30 points per cold, 30 points of heat or cold damage resistance per round, I feel like you should just be immune to heat and cold damage for the length of the spell. That just seems easier to me. But whatever, it's not a big deal.
At that point, you kind of are, is what I was getting at.
I agree with that, Jeff. But I will say, if you're fighting a dragon and you, for whatever reason, know that he breathes hot or cold or whatever, you know, it takes one action to cast. So that's pretty hot, actually. That's pretty great, I should say. It's really that could be extremely useful. I mean, this can be a game changer in those encounters that are really tailored to that.
And if it's a sphere of resistance 50 feet around him, and then everyone gets that damage reduction and a +6 bonus to all their saving throws against the same, that really knocks down that 80 hit point Bragondreth, right?
Mm-hmm. And Julian, I would say this is my version of your Food of the Gods spell, because you said like you almost never, or maybe literally never, have seen anybody cast Food of the Gods. I have multiple characters in my stack of sheets that have resist cold or heat on their spell list, and nobody ever casts this
thing. Yeah. Is it? I mean, honestly, guys, I don't know if we need to have an answer, but is this a spell that would be in the DCC core rulebook if it was not a spell that was in every version of D&D? I don't know.
Well, I do like the fact that you choose one at the time of casting, so it doesn't hold the potential of two different spell slots.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's not two different spells that take up your list.
Mm-hmm. And you can actually cast it twice, more or less overlapping, and resist both effects, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, do they stack?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
They can. Okay. They can if you actually successfully cast them together.
Oh, and create a resistance to both. I get it.
Then, okay. Judge Jeff, you have to help your newbie con player track two different results against two different environmental hazards.
Okay. So that's where the little chits or markers come into play. Just throw the glass beads out, red, blue. All right.
Or that's when the shot glasses come out.
Yeah, that too, depending on your setting.
The flask.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, geez, are we back to me?
Yeah.
Yeah, second sight. Yeah, this one, I'm tepid. It's one of those that takes a turn to cast as opposed to a round. And at first, it just gives you a +4 bonus to a single roll on your next round. So, kind of lame. And then it immediately escalates to a form of augury. So the player can tell whether an upcoming action is going to be either a bane or a boon. And basically, depending on how high you roll, the info that you glean, you have from 75% to a 99% chance of getting correct information. So you basically, roll the bones, check the entrails, inquire of your god, what have you, and say, hey, judge, I'm going to do this. Are we all going to die? Or is it going to be a good thing or a bad thing? And how detailed the answer is completely up to the judge, I think. Sometimes it's a flat yes or no. Sometimes it's, well, yes, but no. And yeah, I think I hate this the most because every single player that has this spell has cast it on me. and I got to sit there and figure out, okay, so they're planning on doing this in the next day. Is it a good thing? Well, yes, but, or no, horrible plan. And it all just like derails the whole game for a good 15, 20 minutes while they sit there and kibitz about what they're going to do next.
It's also quite powerful at the high levels. For the next, going at the highest result, for the next month, the cleric receives an ongoing sense of possible outcomes. And every significant
you guys hate the judge.
Yes, at every significant decision or juncture, he receives a premonition regarding the decision he must make, a sense of foreboding or certitude, et cetera, et cetera. 99% chance accurate. So imagine, I've never seen anybody blast up that high. Of course, you can't spell burn on these. Thank God. No pun intended. I will say, but I especially love the use of sortilege, the use of cards for divination, and even better, haruspicy, which is the reading of the entrails.
You notice we're not helping. Yes. Sorry.
And then I have to shout out Doug's super apropos. He's got like a picture of one of the manifestations down at the bottom of page 267. Now this is the fourth printing. I think it has extra art.
Yeah, the new
stuff.
Art.
But that's very cool and totally matches the spell manifestation. Plus, it doesn't look quite like you would first imagine it. So it's like an added bonus of that manifestation in a sense. So anyway. And she's wearing a Flavor Flav clock.
Yeah, this is one of those spells. I really dig the fact that once again, it's one of those spells where the lowest level is pretty lame and the highest level is totally game breaking. And I think I totally hear you, Jen. It can be a very frustrating spell to have cast as the judge. Also, I've had some fun with it though as a judge because this is just the roll of the dice, but there was a woman named Basha who was playing in a campaign that I ran for a short period of time, and she was playing a cleric named Gloria, and Gloria ended up casting Second Sight twice in a row in the same adventure. And both times I did my little secret roll to see if she got whether I'm going to give her the correct answer or not. And both times I rolled high enough that I was giving her the wrong answer. So that was pretty fun that like both times she asked her God for some advice. And I gave her just horrible, horrible advice both times. So I appreciate that aspect of Second Sight.
All right. We have one more here, guys. Let's kick this puppy.
All right, word of command. This, of course, is one of the most popular and useful cleric spells. One
game
round
breaker.
Cast, yes, can be a game breaker a little, but that's a good thing. I mean, we want stuff to happen. Duration of one round or more, one word command. 30 foot for low results, line of sight, can be up to a mile, et cetera, et cetera. And there can be, bonuses to saves to resist if the command is quite arbitrary and or unreasonable. It's a powerful, definitely one of the most powerful and useful spells. And with the one round casting time is quite useful in combat and in the tricky situations, although it does specify one round, not one action, right? So the cleric should is that right?
It does say one round.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, as opposed to one action.
So in theory, you would only get it at the start of the next round.
One would think. Hmm. One would also think there'd be like a language barrier caveat, which there is not.
Huh, that's an interesting one too.
It specifies a single word, and in some of the flavor text, you have to make a gesture to illustrate, like go or attack while you're pointing.
So I'd like to apologize to all of the judges because I might be giving some players some ideas here. But let's say, for example, I was at your table, either one of you, and my character casts word of command, and the word that I want to use is obey. And I point to me. Obey me. Does that mean that I can then tell you whatever else I want to do from there forward?
It depends on which result you get, because there are some that actually say, you can combine it with a gesture that clarifies its intent. There's no clarification to that.
I would say to stop you from power gaming me to death, I would say that little caveat in the description, the target, the command is interpreted by the creature's natural thought processes. e.g. issuing an attack command to an herbivore may have a different response than to a carnivore. And I would say that, and it also, next sense, that it may be subject to misinterpretation. So, you know, if you can actually get this into a highly intelligent creature, which is likely to have a really good save, he knows exactly what obey means, which might be useful if you get a high result and have a long duration. But for a, but you know, at lower levels where you're actually likely to get lower powered stuff, you know, what you're going to be a lot better off with jump, swim, eat, run, you know, and stuff that lower intelligence critters would understand. I mean, it would be very situational.
I guess the reason I'm asking specifically is looking at that really juicy 32 plus result with word of command.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, everyone you can see has to follow this word, and it lasts for 1d7 days plus caster level. So best case scenario, you could be standing at the top of a castle looking down upon an army. And if you would permit the word obey to be shouted out at this army of soldiers, you now have an army of soldiers who will obey your every command for up to 17 days, potentially.
Well, they get a new will save each morning, which is handy.
Of a 32
yeah.
plus.
If they're 4 hit die or higher, they all get their own saves, which is, you know, at a 32 still sucks.
I'm going to be very hard on that obey thing. I mean, you know,
it's a lot like charm person and it can break a game.
Yeah, but it
can break a game even with grovel or silence or an actual action. I don't know that you need it to be that full of overkill.
Yeah, because if you just say attack, that means for the next 17 days, they're just attacking everything, I would imagine. So that's pretty game-breaking, too.
Yeah, it's...
Well,
yeah.
I mean, not really, because if you're staring at a big army and they all start attacking everything at sight, in a day, they're all dead. But if you have a giant army that's obeying you for the next 17 days... That's pretty game breaking.
Okay, so now that we've gone through our tomes here, you know, we haven't visited Patron Bond in a while.
Who are you?
Your new lord and master.
What orders from Mordor, my lord?
Oh, don't trouble. One thing I can't stand, it's people groveling.
Lord.
Patron Bond.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, Patron Bond. Pop quiz. Judge Julian, which is the best or your favorite of the level one cleric spells?
I would say I still like Sanctuary, Holy Sanctuary quite a bit. I think it's written well. It has a great range, etc. And least favorite, I'm going Protection from Evil probably.
Interesting. Judge Jeff.
For me, for my favorite spell, it has to be a spell where the lowest result is kind of lame, the highest result is totally amazingly game-breaking, and that it's fun for both the judge and the players. So for that, if we're going to count Divine Aid as a spell, I'm going to give it to Divine Aid. If we're not counting that as a spell, I'm going to give it to Holy Sanctuary, because both of those completely meet those qualifications. And then my least favorite spell, I'd probably just give to Resist Cold or Heat, because I've seen so many characters who have it on their sheet and just nobody uses it. And when it's on my character sheet, I'm just like, oh, that's kind of a wasted spot.
Okay, so for mine, I'm actually going to go with Blessing, because I like the versatility of it. And it is, of course, most advantageous to cast upon yourself and thus affect your allies. But if you're splitting the party for some reason, I kind of like the ability to still have an effect on the rest of my party, even if they're not in the same room. My least favorite, yeah, we've already covered that. Second Sight, I've never been a fan of Augury in D&D. Second Sight, pretty much for the same reason. If I want to know what I'm walking into. And... as a judge, oh God, I didn't know. Okay, quick That's and dirty fair. Patron bond covered.
Yay.
We have just a little bit more business to attend to. We need to head over to the Dungeon Denizen area.
Go on, boar, chop his head off.
Right, silly little speeder.
Jesus Christ! I warned you.
My armor is like tenfold shields. My teeth are like swords. My claws, spears.
And with our long neglected Dungeon Denizen segment, we need to announce the winner of our Win a Stefan Pogue illustration for your Dungeon Denizen contest.
Woohoo!
Yes. And
I think this was unanimous. This person had the most original submission. The Lamunculus, submitted by Tim White. And this was the small 18-inch high creature that was made by wizards for exploring dark passages. A lot of wizards don't survive for very long, even with someone breaking point like that. So these little guys could be found wandering around on their own. And the crystals in the head power the light that emits from its face, and really clever wizards mix the crystals to enable the light to have different effects. And yeah, really good, cool write-up, and we will definitely be hosting that on the page.
There was a lot of weird, like, sometimes they get away, sometimes they grow to huge. I mean, it's just all this variability, and there's five or six really weird, neat ideas in just that write-up. It was really neat. We had some great submissions, though. They were all really,
oh, yeah.
They were mm-hmm. all really good, and they all really could have been kind of first choices. So this was a crowded field. We didn't get a ton of submissions, but they were all really good, actually. Including one, I'm going to just digress for 30 seconds to say, including one by the Honorable Daniel J. Bishop, who, as a steady contributor to Spellburn on the comments section of the spellburn.com website, I finally decided unilaterally to promote him to honorary judge, Daniel Joseph Bishop. So, Judge Daniel Joseph, you are hereby promoted to honorary Spellburn judge because for your contributions to DCC, of course, as a prolific and highly qualified writer, as well as your numerous tidbits of wisdom as a blogger and in the comments section, especially. So thank you for that, and receive your honor with all due respect and admiration.
And inoculations. Yes.
And yes, and inoculations. Very well. Onward, Jen.
Just a quick little bit of business. There was an email from the Dark Master regarding Rodney submissions. In case anybody ignored that email, we'd be remiss if we did not pass it on. And the gist of it is, don't be afraid to approach third-party publishers with your adventure ideas. And I feel it's really important for us to bring up, since we are so community driven. I know a ton of us submitted things for the Rodneys, and there's no reason they shouldn't see the light of day just because they didn't get the Rodney Award. So get out there, get your stuff published.
It's worth noting that not every industry has the kind of the preeminent publisher or, you know, or a corporate, you know, leader or whatever you want to say, actually email people and say, hey, that was really good work. Don't be afraid to go to my competitors and, you know, get great stuff out there. I mean, it's pretty cool. I'm glad that we have that kind of openness and stuff.
Yes, the Dark Master is benevolent.
And I would add to that also, don't be afraid to put it out yourself, too. I mean, Claytonian's Wizardarium of Calabraxis or James McGeorge's
Black Sun Deathcrawl.
Thank you. Black Sun, Deathcrawl are all great examples of just like self-published and fantastic adventures.
Indeed. Very good points. And Marzio's first adventure, right? The 2017 Rodney winner, the Death Slaves of, he had also self-published his Death Slaves of Eternity, right? So.
Yeah. Or did he do that through Purple Duck?
Oh, well, you're okay, right.
But
that
third
is
party
Duck.
Then, not self-published. But
yeah.
But
yeah. So we've got Purple Duck, Purple Sorcerer, Stormlord Publishing, Thick Skull Adventures, Order of the Quill.
Indeed.
Yeah, there's much.
Mike Evans,
Steve,
DIY.
That's... Steve Bean Games.
Yes, very much so. Yes, so whole lots of third-party publishers.
Shinobi 27.
Send your stuff in, yes. Mystic Bull. Yeah. I do not have a comprehensive list in front of me, and I am woefully behind on reading all of my third-party acquisitions, but, you know, off the top of my head, so don't sue me. So we hope that as a first level, or even second or third cleric coming into the game, you're not as intimidated or confused by the shorter list of spells here. There really are a myriad of effects that can come out of each one. And besides healing people, get out there and game. Be the best cleric you can. Or the best confused caster. Or wizard with cleric leanings. Or however you would like to phrase it, right? All right, so stay tuned till next episode. Rumor has it we have a special guest coming in with us, and game on, guys.
So long, farewell, Auf Wiedersehen, good night.
You've been listening to Spellbird, copyright 2017. Our theme song has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. Learn more at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com.